community-minded conversations all across Wisconsin. You can find us at civicmedia.us and download the app for free today. Hi, I'm Jimmy Cusco, sports director for Civic Media. Right now, we're airing a Packers, Badgers, Brewers, or Bucks game over the air, but due to our rights agreements, we're not able to stream those games here. Civic Media might be a newer company, but we are dedicated to providing the best in sports coverage. Our team has decades of experience covering sports right here in Wisconsin. We've got Mike Clements, who covers our state's biggest teams on location and does daily updates on all of our Civic Media stations statewide. Many of our stations have local reporters dedicated to teams in their area, covering their community dozens or even hundreds of times each year. No matter where you're at in Wisconsin, we are committed to covering sports, especially in the communities that our stations serve. And we put all of our local coverage right here on our stream, so you can go ahead and grab the free Civic Media app so you never miss a game at civicmedia.us/app. You can find the game you're looking for over the air, or you can stay tuned right here on the stream for more news, talk, and conversation. Thank you for listening to Civic Media from all of us here on the sports team.
Local news, weather, and sports on air and streaming on the Civic Media app. This is the Civic Media Radio Network.
Game two of the Brewers and Dodgers. Hi, I'm Mike Clemens with sports from American Family Field, where the Brewers host the LA Dodgers. The Brewers winning last night 9-1. The Dodgers now trying to snap a four-game losing streak. They got swept at home over the weekend at Dodgers Stadium against the Houston Astros, who beat them 18-1 Friday night. The Brewers rookie Jacob Mizorowski against Clayton Kershaw for LA. We learned today that first baseman Rhys Hoskins will be out until August with an injured left thumb suffered over the weekend against Miami. So why are they playing newcomer Andrew Vaughn instead of Jake Bauer at first? Vaughn with a three-run homer last night. Manager Pat Murphy.
Yeah, Vaughn versus Yamamoto last night. I just felt like, one, Yamamoto's kind of an even split guy, but, you know, he just got off the plane, no time to think. He's back in the big leagues. I just thought it was the right move. It worked out. Will he always face right-handers? No, maybe not. I'm very comfortable with Bauer's out there.
That's Pat Murphy. We'll have a full recap of the game later tonight with sports. I'm Mike Clemens.
The Maggie Dawn Show.
Madam Mayor Satya Rhodes Conway from the fabulous city of Madison.
A lot of people say, I don't like politics. It's all dirty and angry and blah, blah, blah. It's really about caring about your community, finding a way to, like, bring it back to people talking to each other.
Yeah.
About what is important in our place and how do we take care of each other and use the levers of government to do that. That's really what it's about.
The award-winning Maggie Dawn Show at its new time, weekdays 4 till 6 p.m.
News, talk, community, and local sports. Thanks for listening to Civic Media.
You're listening to pre-recorded content.
It's time for the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here today on the big program. Lots to get to, lots to talk about. Had a lot of comments about the big, beautiful nightmare bill. Lots of folks saying, hey, this is bad. It's bad for working people. It's bad for the poor. Yeah, well, yeah, screw the poor. Got a lot of that. In fact, one guy said, you know, I only go to doctors who don't accept Medicaid. Wow. Talk privilege. But here's one of these things where, here you go again. Under the guise of efficiency, the VA, you remember those folks, the Veterans Administration? You know, the people who are charged with taking care of our heroes, the people that we put up on platforms, and how wonderful, and thank goodness for our freedoms. We put ribbons on cars. Well, when it comes to taking care of them, we don't seem to, politically anyway, don't seem to care. And under the guise of efficiency, it's going to be the people who work at the VA and obviously the veterans who are going to pay the price. It's going to be working people and veterans who pay the price. Now, the VA has said, and the headline was amazing, that, you know, they've backed off. You know, getting rid of 90,000. We're only going to get rid of 30,000. And while they're patting themselves on the back, saying, well, you know, 17,000 are already out the door, the rest will come, you know, later in the year, sometime around September. And they're again calling it attrition. You know, people are just going to retire. Understand. it's just a nicer way of saying these jobs are going to disappear. Once the person retires, there's no job for someone else to step into. So instead of having the headlines going, hey, mass firings, no, people just left and the jobs evaporated. And understand, you've got most of the VA under a hiring freeze and you're going to be cutting other places. What's that going to mean for our veterans? What's it going to mean when all of these positions are gone? And you've expanded the number of people eligible through the PACT Act to get care. What's that going to mean? Now, you got people like Secretary Collins who are pretending that this is some kind of master plan to reduce bureaucracy and improve service. And my thought goes, from a common sense point of view, how is it that gutting 80,000, 90,000, or even just 30,000, how's that going to improve anything? It is truly smoke and mirrors. And the thing that's interesting is most of this has been held under wraps. Most of this has been held out of public purview because, well, they're getting the retirees with their little bonus checks to sign NDAs. So they can't say what happened. And again, this is a tactic from corporate America. This, again, is what happens when you run government like a business. And it was only because some working people, their unions, and a number of us in the public were going, hey, this is bad. That's what made them back off. It would have been worse without this. Don't be fooled. They're still going to be going after more layoffs. They're going to still be going after reorganization. And all it really means is there are going to be fewer people doing more work for less pay. And ultimately, it's the veterans. Remember them? The heroes? It's going to be them who are the ones who suffered. Now, understand, the VA workers, about a third of them are veterans themselves. So not only are they going to lose their jobs, yeah, they're not going to get the care either. And understand, these just aren't numbers on a spreadsheet. These are people. And like I said, a third of them are those veterans we put up on a pedestal. So cutting these jobs isn't just horrible, terrible policy. It's a slap in the face to those vets and to every working person in the entire system. And what we know that by slashing and burning employment, you're going to have much longer wait times, which means fewer staff, veterans are going to wait much longer. The quality of care is going to diminish. Because, hey, there's only so many people to go around. If you've got mistakes that are going on, you've got rushed visits, you've got less attention to each veteran, you've got real problems. And for me, the big one is you're going to burn people out. So you're going to lose the specialized expertise of having people who know veterans' issues, which is the plan. Understand, all of this, all of the defunding, all of the layoffs, all the stuff that's coming this way is about destroying the VA. It's about destroying all of government. But in this instance, it's just about that because we've got to save it. And the only way to save it, my friends, you got it. Burn it to the ground. And if we can't lay people off, we're just going to burn them out because what will happen is even with 30,000 people gone, someone's still got to do that job. With 90,000 people, someone's got to do that job. So you've got the remaining workers who are going to be stretched thin. They're going to be angry. They're going to be disengaged, disenfranchised. And ultimately, they're going to take their skills and go somewhere else. And that is a problem when you consider that the existing staffing shortage we have in the VA, over 80% of them, the facilities in the VA are already suffering from nursing shortages, severe shortages. So now you're going to pile more on. Again, it's a recipe for disaster. But again, like many things, it is the plan. It is what they want. And it's that old adage, you know, we're going to kill it to destroy it, or destroy it to kill it, or to save it. How does it go again? Oh, yeah, we don't care. Just as long as we put money in the pockets of rich people. Because again, you come back to the big, beautiful bill. It's really what it was about. Taking from the people who work, who do the work, pay the taxes, and give to the people who the hardest day's job they do all day is moving money from one pocket to the other. From your pocket to theirs. And that's the frustrating part in this for me. So I've been saying, you know, all the years I've been doing this show, veterans are our heroes. And if this is how we, as a nation, allow heroes to be treated, who's going to be the next generation of heroes? Who's going to step forward in the next moment of need, the next crisis, the next war? Who is going to step up? That's the question. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Going to take a quick break. When we come back, Bobby Kogan from the Center for American Progress going to be here to share some thoughts on the big, beautiful nightmare. Back after this.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors, the American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So, the big, beautiful nightmare passed, and interestingly enough, a lot of email on the horrible, I can't believe they did this, and some Red Hat folks going, you know, I'm surprised, I'm shocked. This is actually going to affect me. And I got to be honest, told you. But here to share some thoughts on just how bad this is, on how bad it's going to be for working people. I've asked Bobby Kogan to come talk with us. Bobby's a senior director of federal budget policy there at the Center for American Progress. You can check out their website, AmericanProgress.org. Bobby, thanks for taking time for us.
Hey, Rick. Thanks so much for having me back on.
So let's start at the beginning. How bad? How bad is this? On the scale of 1 to 10, where are we?
I would say it is near the upper end of what we thought. Oh, at least what I thought was possible in terms of what they would pass. Some of the very, very worst things that they were contemplating didn't make it into this bill. So, for instance, they were looking at turning Medicaid into a block grant with per capita caps. That didn't get in. But adjusting for that, this was near the worst. Right? These are not only the biggest Medicaid cuts in history, these are by far the biggest Medicaid cuts in history, right? Like roughly four times as large as the Reagan cuts. Biggest SNAP cuts in history by a decent chunk. And then at the same time, it's making the poor poorer, and at the same time, it's doing that to help justify making the rich richer.
No, it's Robin Hood in reverse. And the question then becomes is how are families going to afford healthcare, food, and basic needs, all of the things that in 2024, people said that's what we cared about, and Biden made our lives worse. What's this going to do?
Right. This is. I mean, you're not helping people if you're taking away their food. You're not helping people if you're taking away their health care. You are not helping people if you're raising their utility costs. And you're not helping people if you're making the economy worse. So it's all around something that actually harms the people who voted for Trump, right? The people who he's theoretically serving, and theoretically the people who the members of Congress are serving. There's one congressman where more than half of his constituents are on Medicaid, and he still voted yes. So I would just say it's a betrayal of what we are supposed to stand for. The government is supposed to be there to serve the people. It is supposed to help people. It's supposed to ameliorate a lot of the unfairness of society, and this goes in the opposite direction. This makes society worse. It harms people, and it leaves people worse off.
No, it comes back to every time we pass one of these budgets, every time we pass one of these budget reconciliation schemes, every time we do this, the question I always ask is, how's this going to help working people? I know how it's going to help the very wealthy. I know Elon Musk is going to be just fine. But I worry about that guy that I met in the parking lot who is homeless, and because of a storm, he lost everything that he has nowhere to go because he's got medical needs and no shelter will take him. How are these cuts, how are these going to help him? How is this bill going to help folks like him? The poor working people that I know who are living in shelters, how's it going to make their lives better? The people who are barely hanging on, how's it going to help them?
Yeah. I mean, the answer is a lot of people who our system already does a bad job of taking care of are going to further fall through the cracks too. You know, things like the work requirements, where they try to set up a whole bunch of exceptions or whatever, but what really happens is people just fall through the cracks, right? And we've seen that actually in the states that have tried to do work requirements, they've been a disaster, where huge numbers of people who are allegedly doing everything right or in one of the, you know, hitting one of the boxes that you need to hit, are nonetheless not getting their benefits. In fact, in Georgia, this guy Luke Seaborn was like basically the poster child for work requirements. He was in a bunch of ads for the governor, and he was like, "Yeah, I'm on Medicaid. I work. I think everyone else is a moocher, and I really support this." That dude lost his health insurance twice in the first 9 months of the program, even though he never changed jobs or anything. And it's just because there was so much red tape put up that it kicked him off of the benefits, and now, shocker, he no longer supports Medicaid work requirements.
Because it affects him. And this is where I've been for the longest time. Look, bad things are going to happen. The phrase I've been using is the solutions are going to come out of the suffering caused by their savagery. This bill is savage. This is going to harm people. And the hope is that we wake up to the reality that, yeah, it is affecting us. It is harming working people. It is harming us in ways that we didn't contemplate before, but it's going to hurt.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, and they're the people who are directly affected. It's also the people indirectly affected, right? Lots of rural hospitals are going to close. Lots of hospitals get a lot of their money from Medicaid. And in addition to this, if you're not covered now anymore, you show up to the emergency room, they still have to cover you. So A, they lost the income, and B, now they're going to have more unpaid for care. A lot of hospitals are going to close because of this. And then even if you didn't lose your health insurance, even if you're fine, you're not part of this, population at all, you're going to be in trouble when you lose your, you know, when there's no hospital to serve you, or there are a lot fewer to serve you. Yep. So just a lot of people are going to be harmed from this bill, all in the name of tax cuts for the rich, while, by the way, increasing the deficit by trillions of dollars, right? Like, you know, you can't justify it in any way that they would try to justify it. None of it makes sense. No. It literally takes from the poor and hurts everyone to give to the rich.
But out of this, the one thing that I think we can all universally agree on, I never want to hear another word from Scott Perry, my congressman, or any member of the Freedom Caucus.
Yeah, they caved, right? But on the other hand, I mean, they said they were gonna demand a whole bunch more things that they didn't get. Turned out that the 30 or so solid no votes turned out to all be yes, except for, you know, Massey and Fitzpatrick. But they got, I mean,
Fitzpatrick isn't in the Freedom Caucus.
Yeah, sorry. Sorry. I was talking about the two no's. Yes. No, Fitzpatrick was the one moderate who voted no, right? Theoretically, the whole bunch of moderates too, who were just pretending. But yeah, so we had one hardliner and one moderate. But yeah, all the Freedom Caucus, they all gave in. But I guess what I'd just say though is they got, if you had asked the Freedom Caucus a year ago, like, what level of Medicaid cuts do you think you're going to get? Like, I don't know if they thought they were really going to get $900 billion of Medicaid cuts.
And work requirements.
To their credit, they succeeded in disenrolling tons of people from Medicaid. They succeeded in their goal of making people worse off.
So much, I guess, the freedom to die early. But, you know, one of the things I do want to push back on, you had said that, you know, like Georgia and the places that have implemented work requirements have been an abysmal failure. For working people, yeah, I would argue it worked exactly as they had planned. I would argue this is exactly why they put these into these. They put all these obstacles and these roadblocks in the way so that people can't get over or around them, and they end up getting thrown off these programs.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. For some of them, it's intentional. I would just say, I think if you talk to the average human being, maybe not the average human being who's implementing the work requirements, but the average human being, work requirements pull well, they sound good. And I think a lot of folks who maybe support the concept, we can win by explaining, like, even if you support the concept, it doesn't succeed, right? It doesn't actually increase work, and it kicks off a whole bunch of people who are working, and it also kicks off your exception population because they have to navigate it too. You have, you're full-time disabled. Well, you need to navigate the red tape as well. Oh, you're a caretaker, you're a mom. Oh, and you're taking care of your kids, you have to navigate this system as well. And so a whole bunch of people, and I think when you show people, like, truthfully, empirically, that these folks are having their lives ruined through this thing that doesn't even achieve its primary goal, yeah, the people who really secretly just wanted to kick everyone off are going to be really happy. But there are a whole, you know, in terms of the public opinion, we can show people that, hey, this thing that you might have supported in concept is was an atrocious disaster that led to, I mean, the estimate is at least 15,000 people dying additionally every year who otherwise wouldn't have died because they lost their, you know, they lost their health insurance. And then of the people who lost health insurance, some of them are going to get sick. And of the people who get sick, some of them are not going to be able to pay any money out of pocket. And of the people who get really sick and can't pay out of pocket, some of them will get so sick they die. And, like, you know, that's just basic logic.
But this does play, and I want to get your thoughts on what I've been, you know, this was a major win for the think tank world, major win for, conservative ideology of pushing things away from the federal government into the states, massive burden shifting. Do you see this as something that states are going to be able to navigate? And what's it going to mean for working people when they fail and do what they basically do literally all the time? And I would argue misuse the funds, especially when it's for poor and working people.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. It's the worry for SNAP, right? So now, under pre-OBBA law, states were just responsible for some portion of running SNAP, just administering it. And now they're going to be responsible for A, a higher administration cost, and then B, somewhere between 0 to 15% of the benefits. And definitely some states have been raising warning flags. No states have completely gone off the Medicaid program, which is a different share program. So I am worried, but I am hopeful no states will drop SNAP entirely. That's the worry, right? The worry is now that you're responsible for a significant amount of money that you didn't budget for, you might just say, that's it, I'm out of the program. And then you would doom 100% of the people in your state who literally need this food. But, you know, the Republican governors all put out a joint letter saying that they supported the bill or whatever. I'm very worried for people. I'm worried about their lost health care, and I'm worried about their lost food.
Yeah. So let me ask you the other side of this, because, you know, I've had a lot of my conservative friends say this is a major win for, you know, freedom. I get this a lot of this liberty. This is restoring, you know, tax dollars to the working people. They're going to be able to make their own choices from that ideological point of view. For the mass of us, not for the folks at the top, the big winners in this bill, but for the mass of us, anything positive in here? Can you point to something? You go, this was good. I mean, because, you know, I can look at just about anything and find good in it. Anything here?
Look, it's a giant bill. There's a little bit of it. There's a little bit of it that's good, right? You think of the first round of Trump tax cuts. I would say on net that was bad, but it basically rewrote the international tax system. It worked to kind of, you know, simplify some aspects of the individual side of the tax code. Some of those things ended up being positive, but they were basically swamped by the badness. So, you know, look, you take these tax cuts, the average benefit for someone making under 100K is $14 per week. Oh, that is more than $0 per week. But it is only 14. And then of those people who lost their Medicaid and SNAP, they are going to be worse off. But there are going to be some people who are a little bit better off. And I guess I think this is a poorly, I think basically the consensus is that this is a poorly designed thing. But he set up a basically a bad version of baby bonds where it's better than some of the worst versions of it, but it is way less good than the best versions of it, where basically they would deposit $1,000 in your name when you're born, and then it would grow with the stock market, and then you would be able to use some of it when you're 18. There's the weird, the administration part is kind of what makes it no sense. There's so many kind of loopholes that's hard to use, but theoretically the point of this was a wealth building thing. And I think that's a legitimately nice thing, but all these people are going to be worse off, you know, or many of these people are going to be worse off anyway. So if you're asking me to say, Bobby, find one thing in the bill that you think is good, that is better than not existing. Like that is it's a progressive thing that will help the poor more than the rich. And like, that's a great, and it's a smarter way of doing it, having it, you know, kind of grow with high yield stuff. But, you know, if you take someone poor, you give them a grand and it gets to grow with the stock market, but then you took away their food and their Medicaid, then they're going to be worse off.
Yeah, no, that's an excellent point. So the question then becomes, how do Democrats use this? Because universally they were opposed to it. And I think not surprisingly, when you're talking about the largest cuts to Medicaid ever, it's not hard to be against this. How do they use this in the next election in 26 and ultimately in 28?
It is incumbent on all of us to make sure there are going to be people being hurt from this, right? There are going to be hospital closures. There are going to be people kicked off of their, you know, of their aid. There are going to be people going hungry. There's food assistance taken away from kids, food assistance taken away from veterans, food assistance taken away from kids aging out of foster care, right? Like there's lots and lots and lots of people are going to be harmed, and it is incumbent on everyone to draw a line between that loss and the specific harm of this bill. Make sure people understand it's so hard, it's so diffuse. Some of the things don't start until 2027. Some don't start until, you know, maybe even later. So it is very difficult to say this bad thing that happened a year and a half from now is actually because of that, but we have to do that. You know, Democrats won the 2018 midterms. In depends who you ask why it happened. My personal theory was, I think we probably would have won anyway, but I think that the bigger thing, the biggest thing going on was the healthcare. Republicans came in, they tried to take away people's healthcare, get rid of protections for pre-existing conditions. Everyone knows someone with a pre-existing condition, and they were doing that to do giant tax cuts for the rich, just like they did here. Yeah. And that was really unpopular, and they failed, and I think it cost them the size of the election was. Because of that, and I think Democrats have to do the same thing.
No, here, I think the reason that the Democrats, you know, sadly, people have such a bad opinion of Democrats in some circles is because while Republicans are doing horrible things, they're doing something. You know, it's they're doing big things in the wrong direction. Democrats never seem to get that pendulum to go back in the other direction to say we're doing good things in the right direction.
Yeah, so I hope that this will be an opportunity to look at our healthcare system. I hope folks will use this as an opportunity to kind of look at, like, we have a patchy, weird healthcare system that has evolved over a long period of time. And if you're setting it from scratch, you wouldn't do it that way. But we aren't setting it from scratch. We're always changing. And I think this has been such a significant change to Medicaid. I hope that we take this as an opportunity to really fix a lot of the things that were broken about it and really help a lot of people who have been falling through the cracks under the old system, right? A lot of folks were very poor, but not quite poor enough.
This is going to make them poorer. You're going to hit rock bottom.
Right. And a lot of folks who were very poor and on Medicaid were nonetheless not having it work right for them, or were poor enough to be on Medicaid and they couldn't figure out a way to make it work. There are huge administrative problems with our healthcare system, even if you qualify, and that's true. In the public market, that's true for public programs. It's true in the private market as well. And I hope that we take it as an opportunity to really help. You know, we are the only advanced nation that doesn't really cover folks. And obviously, there are some good things. There's some good things about.
Yeah, there's some good things. Yeah.
Sorry, my thing just froze. But yeah, there are some good things about our healthcare system, but there are a lot of problems with our healthcare system as well. And I hope that they take this as an opportunity. And I would just say on health as well, we have profoundly meager benefits. The average benefit for SNAP is $2 per person per meal. People cannot survive on SNAP, right? The point is to be supplemental, but it is incredibly, incredibly, incredibly meager. And I hope that we take this as an opportunity to build out our nutrition assistance, where in a country, you know, that we are the richest country in the history of the world, and nonetheless we have food insecurity, and that's a completely inexcusable thing. There's no reason anyone should be going hungry.
And this is, like, as I've been saying, this is going to give Democrats an opportunity to actually run on an agenda that's going to make people's lives better. But Bobby, I appreciate the time, the inputs. I look forward to talking to you again real soon.
Thanks for having me on, Rick.
Bobby Kogan, Senior Director of Federal Budget Policy there at the Center for American Progress. Make sure you check out their website, AmericanProgress.org. Want to hear your thoughts. Something in this, something we talked about that's going to make your life better, worse? I want to hear about it. Rick at TheRickSmithShow.com. Right back. Stick around.
Thanks for listening. Your spot for local sports coverage is Civic Media.
As Wisconsin has summer weekends being spent on the lake, this is the Civic Media Radio Network.
Civic Media is your spot for sports. From updates on your favorite teams, live broadcasts of the Packers, Badgers, Brewers, and Bucks, and local sports coverage in your community, we've got everything you need. Find a station near you at civicmedia.us or download the free app today. We'll have more news and talk coming up here on Civic Media's stream.
Nightlight with Pete Schwabba.
Years ago, I had I think I had a rainbow. No, it was a shirt. It was given to me, and I wore it because I support all people. And a friend of mine, like, sure, you want to walk around in that? You know, a t-shirt, people might think. I'm like, people might think I'm a human being that supports other human beings. I wear sports jerseys sometimes. No one ever says, are you worried people are going to think you're on the Cubs?
I don't think anyone would think that, though.
Oh, you haven't seen my curveball.
Nightlight with Pete Schwabba. Weeknights from 6 till 8 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the Civic Media app.
You're listening to pre-recorded content.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So the other day, the Department of Labor issued a press release saying that they were going to award some, I think it's $84 million in grants to expand registered apprenticeship programs. And look, as you know, huge supporter of union apprenticeship programs, huge supporter of the work that they do. In fact, trying to get my own kid into one of them. I think they're that good, and the kind of future that they provide for working people, priceless. So if we're going to invest a little bit to make those programs stronger, I'm 100% on board, even if Trump's got his name on it. Because again, I think, there's an opportunity here. And here to share some thoughts on, because I got to tell you, my first, a little skeptical. Anything with Trump's got his name on it, especially when it's money, a little skeptical. And that's why I've asked John LaConch to come share some thoughts. He's the executive director of Liuna's Education and Training Fund. You can check out their website, liunatraining.org. John, thanks for taking time for us.
Thanks, Rick. Thanks for having me on.
So, is it fair to be skeptical? Because look, I saw this press release, and my first thought is, yeah, this seems like a way of taking public dollars and putting it into private hands. So any thoughts?
Yeah, and it's interesting. Two things are happening. One, around the same time, is they're coming out with a change to the regulations in apprenticeship and deleting the what they call the DEIA stuff, right? So here they are announcing this money for apprenticeship, but at the same time, they're coming out with a new 29 CFR that may contradict some of the stuff that's in here, only because of what they're doing is removing what they feel is not appropriate areas in terms of DEIA that used to be a strong component in here, especially when you're looking at some of the individuals who could be affected. So you're right in being a little suspicious there.
And the other part, John, for me is, look, this administration, like none other in my lifetime, has been incredibly anti-union. going after and trying to strip federal workers of collective bargaining rights. Yep. You look at all of the things that they're doing on the sidelines, trying to strip collective bargaining rights and weaken them. So when I see this and I go, this could be good for people with collective bargaining agreements, is it fair to be, is it rational to be skeptical?
Yeah, there are some things in that. And I think the other thing, and I've been kind of answering this question, Rick, so to be sure, when I say this is a continuation, this isn't something that the administration dreamed up brand new that has never happened before. There have been funding cycles like this by the Department of Labor, so it's not this brandy new thing, and it does help perpetuate positive stuff towards apprenticeship, especially in youth and pre-apprenticeship, a focus on veterans. But there are a couple of differences in this one in terms of, one, they have this pay for performance model. And I always, I mean, this is just 46 years of experience. When you look at this money is under a 3-year obligation. So if you happen to be in a state and apply and get the money, it's for 3 years. And a lot of times when you have pay for performance, you then focus less on quality and more on quantity, right? So that the number of apprentices enrolled, the new programs registered. And you made a good point. When you look at this focus, well, we're going to send the money to states and let the states do it. That creates this administrative burden, number one, that the process is going to be different for each state. How they implement it is going to be different for each state. And they have more, they'll have more power to maybe even splinter programs, right? So you have an established program like the laborers do, and somebody will put in for maybe a subpar program that looks like a new program, but it's only a continuation of one that already exists. So that ends up always being a problem, because you're fighting against what somebody designates as a new program, and in fact it's already part of an existing program.
Yeah, and for me, I've seen this movie before. We had Governor Corbett here in Pennsylvania a number of years ago, and some of the money that was supposed to go to apprenticeship programs, I saw going to what I'll call unscrupulous contractors who have they've got apprenticeship programs, but are they really? Because their percentage of people actually completing and finishing them seem to be very low, at least from my perspective as an outsider looking in. And the fact that you've added this pay-for-play thing in a short period of time, there's a lot here to me that seems like there could be some shenanigans. Or is that just me being skeptical? Because look, as you pointed out earlier, the administration has some good stuff potentially in here if it's actually done the way it should be.
And I think it's a discussion. I even think it's a discussion you and I had before. You talk about sustainability. So the trade unions have set up a program with our union contractors that are not a burden on a taxpayer, right? So we're sustainable and have been for years and years and years. We don't need grant programs to keep our programs going. Do grants help? Absolutely. Is there a burden to taxpayers? Sure. So one of the points that you made, kind of when you look at this, when you look at both the totals for each state and then a 3-year time frame to come up and going, what happens after the end of 3 years? Are they creating a sustainable program that can last after the grant funding dries up? And that really is becomes an issue.
No, that's an excellent point. But the part for me that I look at, again, and I come back to this, this belief that you guys do really great work. Union building trades folks are the best trained, most productive workers. My concern is that this is a push to get programs in place to anoint people as whatever, so that you could flood the market, lower wages, and basically bottom things out. Again, I'm keeping my skeptical hat on. Do you see this as potentially a way for folks to, you know, weaken collective bargaining practices by ensuring that, well, we have a whole bunch of people who claim to have skills, but, well, not so much?
I'll tell you, this idea of focusing on creating pathways sounds great and is important, but the catch in the way things are worded is creating pathways to a living wage and a job with benefits, rather than focusing on ensuring that individuals who are going through a registered apprenticeship program are already guaranteed the beginning of those living wages. Sure, we know it's a reduced amount until they get a certain number of hours in, but for our union programs, they come in at a lower percentage of rate, but they're getting their benefits. And there is an identifiable wage progression that we're not really seeing here. So you're not too far off the
because here's where my concern is. Look, to my core, viscerally, I believe this administration is the most anti-union of my lifetime. So when I see something, you go, oh, this could actually be good. I'm always looking for that. Where's the devil in the detail? Because my concern is, and maybe you share this, is that we're now going to spend a bunch of taxpayer dollars to prop up these other programs with the express goal of, not written, but with the goal of undermining what you guys have done for decades and done incredibly well. And then, you know, privatize, profitize, and doing what they do. Again, skeptical thoughts?
Yeah, no, you hit on quality, sustainability, and then just this administrative burden. And unfortunately, this state-by-state approach really gives a lot of power to whoever gets the money and what organization criteria they set up for that. And I'll tell you, I want to be fair. We are really big in the high schools and in our pre-apprenticeship program and our job readiness programs. And there is one key component that gives me hope, Rick, right? So we pointed out those things that are nurse. In past programs, you know, kids working at the age of 16 and 17 and 18, instead of going to school and becoming educated and then working their way up, right? So in their pre-apprenticeship programs, and again, with our, for instance, our high school program that brings a kid 4 years through our apprenticeship program, they're not taking the jobs of already established apprentices and journey workers, right? So they actually have in here, very surprisingly, and we were happy about it, that these kids will be not taking jobs away from people who are already working, but in fact learning.
No,
so
that's huge.
Positive.
No, because look, you look at the rest of the state, a lot of states across the country are weakening child labor laws. And it's been my view, just for what you said, get it to where, hey, we can get those 13-year-olds to get out there and start humping bricks. Let's get to it. Because, hey, we need competition for mom and dad.
Yes, you got it. You hit it on the head. And we were, so, you know, as we went through the whole cycle and getting ready for the, and by the way, it's interesting, to date, I checked right before coming on that the money is released. The states haven't begun releasing it yet. So we're still sort of waiting for, they said a possibility of approximately July 1st, but to yet no funding has started yet on the state level. So for us in the unions, we have sustainability. We work with our union employers, and we really see this as a boon for our pre-apprenticeship program to bring those people in who are either in youth, 16 to 24, or for veterans, which is always, I mean, I think you know, Rick, we have Helmets to Hard Hats and other veterans programs that have been targeting veterans for years and years and years.
No, we've had numerous people on over the years, and it's a great program, an important program. But let me ask you this, $84 million sounds like a lot of money to me. It does. $84 million is a lot of money, but is it?
Yeah, so you're talking, there. The $84 million is split into two groups. About $50-plus million is for grants that are just, or for apprenticeship programs that are just starting, and then the remaining $30 million or so is going to be what they call programs that are ready to go, right? in the first batch, the bigger batch, you're only talking between maybe $300,000 to $1 million per state. Not a lot of money when you think about the number of apprenticeship programs coming in, and when you think about like what our union invests in apprenticeship, right? Not even close. And then again, when you look at even the competitive grants, in some states, they're between 3 to 5 million for the whole state over a 3-year period.
So we're not talking, because look, I saw the headline and go, wow, $84 million is a lot of money. It really a commitment. This doesn't seem to be like that much of a commitment then. If this is, and look, I'm a huge supporter of this. And Trump has talked big on and investing in infrastructure and on training the next generation of workers and all of that, which has gotten him a lot of PR. But $84 million, I'm not trying to be ungrateful, but doesn't seem like the kind of investment, the kind of robust investment that we need.
Well, I mean, give you a comparison. One union, just LIUNA, we invest in over $200 million a year between us and our employer partners for our training and apprenticeship program, just for our union and just for our 500, almost 600,000 members right now. So when you look at $85 million and across every state, that, you know, that $1 million doesn't go as long, especially if you're talking about a three-year project,
right?
Even to seed a program, what happens afterwards? Where's the sustainability beyond it? So there are good things when it comes to the youth and their pre-apprenticeship. We really are excited and surprised about it, but you're not too far from where we still need to be cautious in terms of where this thing goes.
So let me change a little bit before I let you go, because the Biden administration was committed to clean energy, committed to infrastructural spending, committed to rebuilding this country, creating the kind of jobs that you're training people to do. We now have Trump back in the White House, and we're kind of doing an about face, Trump's executive order to pause disbursements of Biden's infrastructure law money. There's about $300 billion left from the bipartisan infrastructure law that hasn't been spent yet. With this about face away from, clean energy and climate resilience and all of that, solar and wind and all of that, as a training person, well, let me start with, are you seeing that? And then as a training person, how does this affect what you're training people for?
Yeah, it was, and there's a whole other area that hasn't even been talked about. So I'll add to that under environmental response, disaster response, hazardous waste, asbestos, lead, all the work that our unions do to clean up, all that funding has been stopped. So that's not even getting the press that the green focus has been, right? So what I pride ourselves on is that for LIUNA, we don't put all our eggs in one basket. And I'm surprised at the administration for even wanting to do that, right? To go, we're cutting solar and wind, which means for us, hundreds of thousands of jobs immediately being stopped. Right. So we're all for coal. We're for nuclear. We do gas and we do wind and solar. And for us in training, even acquiring Rick, our certifications, everything is stopped now because you don't want to invest in something because the jobs that are ongoing are going to end. And then there's no new jobs moving forward without these tax incentives. So it literally was a brake on a car. It stopped.
Yeah. So everybody, going, this is the administration, the job creators, doesn't sound like so much.
No. And it's too, and again, you know how it goes. He focuses on one area to get what he considers the votes. And what we say as both a union and a union employers is we'll do it all. We'll do pipeline. We will do coal. But we'll also do renewable energy. And again, in the training end, we were stopped cold, and you have hundreds of thousands of workers who are not going to be employed shortly.
Not to mention, look, I talk about business investment and this kind of back and forth business investment is going to dry up and go away. From a training perspective, you know, this kind of back and forth can't be good either. I mean, skills are skills. You learn how to do something, you can adapt them certainly, but it seems like a lot of wasted energy and time to have this back and forth. Seems like if we had a set policy, we might be a little bit better off.
And you hit it on the head too, because Rick, think of it. What people don't see is just take a certification that ensures that a worker has the credentials they need to do a job right and safely. Well, people don't realize that takes a year to develop. Yeah. So for a training person, that's what we're doing, right? We're spending that time, and suddenly we have to stop to look at, well, is now this investment going to be worth it, because there are going to be no jobs at the end of the tunnel. So I appreciate you recognize what a training organization has to go through. But a lot of people don't see that quality takes a year to a year and a half to establish.
Yeah. And especially since, you know, we've had decades of underinvestment in this, to now go, oh, we're going to ramp up and we're going to do all this stuff. Yeah. Good luck with not having the skilled manpower yet. It seems like we got a lot of work to do.
Yep. Agreed.
John, I appreciate the time. Thanks so much. I look forward to talking to you again real soon.
Thanks, Rick. Appreciate it.
I want to hear your thoughts. John LeConte, the chief cook and bottle washer over there at Liuna's training program. Check out their website, liunatraining.org. But I want to hear your thoughts. $84 million sound like a lot to you? Is something we should be maybe bumping up? Maybe we should just not be starting new things, but actually invest in the things we've had? I want to hear your thoughts. Rick at TheRickSmithShow.com. Quick break. Right back. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. This day in labor history, the year was 1966. That was the day that the International Association of Machinists went out on strike. The day before, the Machinists newsletter, published out of Washington, D.C., declared strike set on 5 airlines. During the first half of the 1960s, the airline industry had invested in new equipment and jet technology. Now those investments were paying off in huge profits, and the workers wanted their share of the booming industry. In the article, IAM President Roy Scheimiller explained, quote, "These corporations netted more than $200 million last year. They are enjoying the greatest prosperity in their history. There is no question of her ability to pay. The issue is whether the employees deserve to share in the prosperity of their industry and how much." He went on to say, "Our members on these airlines are not satisfied with the offers made in negotiations so far. Under the American system and under American labor law, they have a right to strike. Only under communism and fascism are human beings forced to work against their will." At 6 a.m., the machinists were called to strike against United, TWA, Eastern, Northwest, and National. The striking workers picketed at 230 airports throughout the United States. It's estimated that 60% of all flights were impacted by the strike. The work action wore on for 3 weeks. Then the White House got involved. President Lyndon B. Johnson helped broker an offer of a 4.5% annual raise for the workers for each of the 3 years. But the union members voted it down. The vote was nearly 3-1 against taking the offer. Finally, the strike was settled after 43 days. The machinist members had won a 6% raise.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
So interestingly enough, you know, as John was talking, my mind went to, because he talked about cleanups, and you look at what's going on in Texas and the disaster that's turned into. I was thinking about what happened in California, and if you remember, Trump, you know, went in and, you know, why does it take so long to get people to get in to clean up? And because there are only so many people who are trained to go in and deal with asbestos and fire-related damage and chemical, you know, waste and all of the things that could literally kill you if you don't know what you're doing. And it seems like, again, this administration loves you know, blissful ignorance. And as I was going through this, you know, having more training, having more information, that's a good thing. Something we should be investing in heavily, but I guess we're not. We're just looking for, we really are, just looking for the press release. Just looking for the, well, the headline. Got an email. I've been getting a bunch of emails on the Epstein thing. Oddly enough, Red Hat friends not thrilled. And I generally don't talk about, you know, Epstein and the conspiratorial stuff. But I got to tell you, from a working class point of view, the idea that Trump didn't fulfill this campaign promise, which could have really, if it's what we're led to believe, could have really just blown open the door of transparency and accountability. But I understand. Trump ran on and repeatedly promised that they were going to reveal the truth. In fact, you had a couple people who were over at the FBI now, Patel and that Bingo Bongo guy, who they this was their life. And then now come out and go, no, there's nothing to see. Move along. You know, he hung himself after years of going, no. You know, Hillary Clinton got her wetsuit on and went in and did some wet. To now have the administration go, nothing to see. Move along. Nothing to see. Now, look, there could be reasons. But I got to tell you, you know, from a working class mindset, it could be easy to fall into the world of conspiracy like a lot of my Red Hat friends have. And also, look, some of the folks on the other side as well. Because from my point of view, just for me, Trump was knee-deep, at least knee-deep, if not eyeballs deep, in whatever was going on Epstein's Island. There are videos of them hugging each other, mucking it up, pointing and giggling. It's all there. So if you were to go, well, just based on that, you could say that one of the reasons that it's not been released is, you know, Trump is eyeballs deep. He's implicated in this. He's part of it. And even Elon Musk said, hey, kind of got to wonder, did Musk get an unredacted look? Don't know. Then there's the other thing. You know, they're powerful allies. We got politicians. We got business leaders. We got celebrities. We got all kinds of kinky, freaky kind of people doing all kinds of horrible things that, you know, you don't want that out there, because we care about our friends, right? If it's poor people, well, screw them. Let them take the full brunt of the law. You could also go with the deep state. This is where my red hats are the justification. You know, it's the deep state who did this. And, you know, we're using this in another conspiracy. The other one that could be that I like is, this is leverage and blackmail stuff. There's a lot of people on that list that need to be controlled. Kind of a J. Edgar Hoover kind of feel. Always that. Or the other part, that there really aren't any files. It's all made up. That this was just a rich guy who liked to fool around, had a propensity for, you know, underage girls, and a group of people who shared that lust. Could be all of that. I don't know. But I do find it interesting that the people who have made their bones, made their names on this, creating this incredible conspiracy, are now, you know, marching in line. And it's the power of money. You know, you wonder why the right-wing echo chamber is so strong. It's how you herd cats. Put out a bag of food, and the cats come running. Here we are. And the cats are running to get into line, because what we're being told, kind of BS, but it's more about, this is how fascistic governments run. This is how corporate governance is. You want to be on the team, you better be in line. You better be loyal. And loyal to whom? Well, dear leader, of course. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Miss any portion of the program? Grab the podcast. And as always, thanks so much for being here. We'll see you back here next time.
been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Email Rick. At rick@thericksmithshow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
This is WISS Berlin Oshkosh and WZBU New Holstein Appleton, the Fox Valley's real news and great conversation, a Civic Media station.
ABC News, I'm Dave Packer. Governor Greg Abbott taking an aerial tour of flood-ravaged Texas hill country, seeing the devastation from the air and then the heartbreak on the ground.
The hearts of our fellow Texans are breaking every single day because of what people of this community and the surrounding area are going through.
At least 87 lives lost to the flooding in Kerr County, 110 statewide, and 173 people unaccounted for. And floods in southern New Mexico today, trapping people in their homes and cars in a popular summer retreat. Emergency crews carrying out at least 85 swift water rescues in the Rodoso area. A massive wildfire closing in on Marseille, France. Fire and smoke racing toward the city. More than 700 firefighters battling the flames. Residents and visitors in the area urged to stay inside, off the roads, the airport suspending flights. The Supreme Court ruling President Trump can go ahead with his plan to drastically downsize the federal workforce. This is ABC News. His family.